The scripture reading this evening will be from 1 Peter 3, 5 through 7. For this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. They were submissive to their own husbands, like Sarah, who obeyed Abraham and called him her master. You are her daughters if you do what is right and do not give way to fear. Husbands, in the same way, be considerate as you live with your wives, and treat them with respect as the weaker partner and as heirs with you of the gracious gift of life, so that nothing will hinder your prayers.
Good evening. We are gathered here this evening to study from the Lord's Word and the series of studies that we've been undertaking over the past few Sundays has been about marriage and family. And this evening, continuing that, I want to suggest how we may have happier marriages and happier families. And of course, when we talk about having happy marriages and happy families, that is the core of what it means to be happy, to be blessed in this life. Certainly possible for us to be happy if we were to be stripped of our family and we still were to have Jesus. But to be embroiled in an unhappy marriage or to be embroiled in an unhappy family is going to make it very difficult even to serve the Lord as He wants us to, or to enjoy the blessings of being a Christian as we ought to. We can, in fact, have happier marriages and happier families if we apply a few principles from the Scripture. Though the Bible is not really a marriage manual, it's not really a parenting manual. Clearly, though, the principles that the Scripture teaches about how we are to relate ourselves to one another, how we're to treat other people, are applicable in that area of life as in other areas of life. And so I have six suggestions this evening for us. If I run out of time, I have seven and eight, but I think six, probably the core of the lesson for today. And number one, the way in which we have happier marriages and happier families is to understand the importance of loyalty to the family. One of the keys that we see about families that are happy is their sense of their obligation to one another, their sense of their unity with one another, their sense of we-ness, if we could make up a word like that. They belong to one another in various important kinds of ways. That family comes before most everything else in this life. Certainly doesn't come before our obligation to God or our obligation to Jesus Christ, but comes before most everything else. I know the Marine Corps, their kind of mantra is God, Corps, country, and family. Some of them just say God, Corps, and country, and that's kind of unique maybe, but I think for most of the rest of us, we understand that the order ought to be God, family, and then country, and then maybe Corps or business or career or whatever else might be important in our life. Family is critical to our well-being. It is in a family that we are nurtured. It is in a family that our personality is shaped and formed. It is in the family that our ability to be gratified, our ability to be happy, is shaped. And once we are grown and we leave father and mother and cleave to a partner and create another family, that family becomes critical to who we are and critical to our happiness. It's not good for the man to be alone, God said, recognizing that it was important for the fulfillment of man the way He had created him and of woman as He created her, that they should be together. And it is clear that when God created the reproduction of mankind, that children come into this world entirely helpless and dependent on their parents. And that's why it's incredibly important that a man and a woman, when they come together to create a child, must be committed to one another and must be committed to that child. That's why the state has a vested interest in marriage. And of course, sometimes people kind of mock that and say, marriage is just a piece of paper, or what business does the government have messing in our bedrooms or in our families? Well, it's important. If children are brought into the world, that somebody is there committed to take care of them, and the family is the unit that has done that throughout history. And the Bible takes for granted this kind of family commitment. You know, one of the things that puzzles me a lot in reading through the book of Acts is the fact that, like when they preached to the Philippian jailer, he and his household were all baptized. Or Lydia, she and her household, they were all baptized. And of course, in our way we think about that today, we consider the issue of, you know, that they baptized the infants, or, you know, was baptism just some kind of ritual? No, I think the understanding is very different, because they understood the family as a unit. They thought together, they worked together, they considered the teaching of the gospel together, and they made a decision. And they were all part and parcel of one another. They made the same decision for the Lord. Of course, there were occasions, I am sure, some of the household would object to that. You see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, where some husbands, some wives are Christians and others are not. But for the most part, family was a family, and if they made a big decision like that, they didn't do it without talking with the others about that. They were a unit about that. And the Bible assumes that's the case. The Bible assumes that they are committed to one another, and that starts with the husband and the wife. They are committed absolutely, unequivocally, until death departs, separates them to one another. That's why God says, I hate divorce, in Malachi chapter 2 and verse 16. I hate divorce. And what he hates about that, as he says, is the falsehood that's involved in that. You made a promise, and now you're betraying that promise. You encourage somebody to trust you, and now you're betraying that trust. I can't stand that kind of falsehood, God says. In fact, the key to our pleasing God is living up to our commitments. In Matthew, or in Psalm chapter 15 and verse 4, the list of those who are going to be dwellers in Zion, one of the characteristics of God's people is they shake hands and they change not. Shouldn't give promises lightly, but you make a promise, you ought to keep it. You say to somebody, I'm going to be there, you ought to be there. You say, I'll return that tomorrow, you ought to return it tomorrow. We're kind of casual about those sorts of things, and we ought not to be. But we ought most of all not to be casual about commitments that we make to one another in marriage. We need to be absolutely committed to the marriage relationship. That means committed to the other person. And of course, that's a hard thing to do. I mean, in this day and age of easy divorce and rethinking as they are doing what the nature of marriage is all about, people say, how in the world can you expect somebody, you know, to be married to the same person for 50 years? You're going to go through changes, maturation. You're going to be an entirely different person 50 years later than you were when you got married. You know, I don't care about that. If you make the commitment, you have to be committed to that. And you just can't change your mind about that. You wouldn't want somebody backing out on you and say, well, I'm sorry, I've grown out of this relationship. You know, that's not what you expected. You expect them to keep their commitment. Of course, I challenge my students in the marriage and family class who are not married and are considering, you know, at some point in the near future, probably about getting married, you know, two things. One is, the person you picked, can you count on them to make that kind of commitment and stick to it? What evidence do you find in their life that they can stick to a commitment of that enormity? If they can't stick to the little commitments, you know, you got to seriously doubt whether they can stick to that commitment. And the other thing, maybe even a more serious challenge, is what kind of evidence could you offer to somebody else? And they say, you know, I want to take a chance on you. I love you, and I'm willing to make that commitment, that lifetime commitment to you. But can I trust you? What evidence can you offer to me that I can trust that you will be committed to me no matter what from henceforth? What evidence could you offer about that? Those are things we ought to consider, that young people ought to consider before they get married. But once we're married, there's no consideration left. You made a commitment, and you need to stick to that commitment. And that doesn't mean surliness. That doesn't mean sullenness. That doesn't mean some kind of half-hearted participation. That means you made a commitment, and you need to stick with that commitment. Doesn't matter what the circumstances around are all about. Doesn't matter. And that's what we say. Richer, poorer, health or sickness, you know, it doesn't matter about those things. You made a commitment, you stick to that commitment. And you can expect the other person to do exactly the same thing. Doesn't matter about how your kind of insides change, what knowledge you have, what kind of experiences you have. You stick to that commitment. That's what you want from them, and that's what you're obligated to give to them. And of course, then we have the fact that children come. And if you have children, you absolutely have to take care of those children. You have no choice about that. You know, it's kind of a parable of the land, a hiss and a byword, I guess, when the children say, I didn't ask to be born. And of course, they got no right to be talking to their parents, making that kind of argument. But the truth of the matter is, that's the case. They didn't ask to be born. You brought them into the world, and now they're yours, your obligation. I don't care. Doesn't matter how tough the job is, doesn't matter how aggravating they are, doesn't matter what kind of problems they may have, they're yours and you're committed to them. If you don't have that basic fundamental commitment, you have no family. If you have no family, then there's no chance really to be happy in this world. Commitment, that's the first thing you have to have. Commitment to your marriage partner and commitment to your children and commitment to your parents and commitment to the family, first and foremost, at least right after our commitment to God. Second thing that we need in order to have sound, satisfying, stable, happy marriages and families is communication. Now, I even hate to say that. That's like all the buzzword. That's what all the pop psychologists talk about. But the truth of the matter is, you got to have communication. You got to talk to one another if you're going to have a relationship with one another. It's kind of what Peter said there in 1 Peter 3 and verse 7 when he said to the husbands, live with them with understanding. And how are you going to understand them if you don't talk to them? Communication is, in fact, a word that means making in common or creating a common meaning. You have to talk to your husband. You have to talk to your wife. You have to talk to your children. If we're going to have a common understanding, we have to talk to one another. Communication, of course, you know, that's buzzword today. Corporations spend $200 million a year trying to communicate with their employees. Everybody wants to figure out how to use social media, Facebook, Twitter accounts. Communicate, communicate, communicate. I don't know whether that's ever going to work out or not. Don't really care about that tonight. But I do know that we need to learn to talk to our spouses. We need to learn to talk to our children. We need to talk to our parents. You know, we live in this day and age which people are connected all the time. Computers by the internet are connected everywhere, all over the world. We have in our pockets, 90% of Americans at least, have cell phones in their pockets so they can text and talk anytime they want. But you despair as to whether there's much communication going on in that. And of course, you know, there's like, is texting really communicating? Well, sometimes we communicate things we don't want to, but I don't care whether, you know, that's considered good communication or, I mean, you got to be in touch with one another and you got to create a common understanding. You think all that's the case, you know, and you think husbands and wives talk to one another? Surveys indicate, diaries that husbands and wives carry around, videos that are taken as they follow husbands' eyes around during the day, reality TV or something like that. 17 minutes. That's about how much time the average couple spends talking to each other a day. 17 minutes a day they spend talking to one another. And you think, is there any real conversation in 17 minutes? It takes me 17 minutes to talk about where I want to go to lunch. Where's the real communication if that's the only time we're... And the truth of the matter is most of that kind of 17 minutes really isn't the kind of talking that creates common understanding. There are five levels of communication which, you know, a couple may engage. One is cliches, you know, and that's what we do with strangers on the street. How are you? Fine. How are you today? Then there's just like reporting. You know, I'll be home at 5 o'clock today. The car is out of gas. That's just reporting. That's not really the kind of communication that's going to make a marriage strong or create a common understanding between parents and children. And then there's the idea of feelings and emotions. I'm tired of this constant whining or judgment. Your manners are atrocious. Well, that's getting a little closer to it, but that's not really going to create a common understanding. That's just judgmental. That's just an expression of emotions. What we really need to get to is something that is much closer to the matter of intimacy, where we talk about what it really makes us feel like, where we talk about and share who we are, self-disclosure, the hard kind of conversation that says, you know, I don't know whether I can make it through this job or not. They're changing everything, and I am scared to death I'm going to lose my job. Or I'm not sure whether I'm able to take care of these kids or not. I think I've really messed up with them, and I need some help about that. The kind of conversation that is intimate about the things that are important to us, that's the kind of conversation you have to have. Create a bond, to create a common understanding. That's the kind of conversation that you would think husbands and wives would have all the time. The kind of conversation which they share their feelings. But all too often, you know, people report being surprised to discover from one of their husband's co-workers or from one of the people at church about their wife that their husband or the wife thinks this, or they enjoy this, or they, you know, think this is the way things ought to be, because they haven't bothered to talk to them. Other people have talked to them. Other people know who they are, but we don't know who the person is that we live with in the house because we don't talk to them enough. You know, the most frequent complaint that wives make about their marriage is, my spouse just doesn't understand me. They just don't understand me. And, you know, the Holy Spirit knew that was the case. Knew that was the case way back in the first century, because that's why the Holy Spirit had Peter write, husbands, live with your wives with understanding. You got to work at it. You got to try and understand them, and you can't understand them without talking. Carl Rogers said, the whole task of psychotherapy is the task of dealing with a failure of communication. And the truth of the matter is, most problems in marriage, most problems in family are a failure to communicate. It's just not talking to one another. If that's the case with husbands and wives, it's even more so the case with parents and children. The most frequent complaint that adolescent children make, my parents don't understand me. Of course, nobody understands teenagers anyway. They don't even understand themselves. But their parents don't understand them. And their parents don't talk to them. And we got to make the time and the effort to try and understand them, or at least make them feel like that we understand them, or at least make them feel like we're trying to understand them or we care to understand them. You know, parents talk to their children about trivial problems sometimes, but that's part of what it's all about. If you don't talk about, you know, it's like you got to start this when they're little, because parents complain about this. My teenagers never tell me anything, you know. It's like I remember they'd come home from school and I'd say, you know, what happened today at school? Nothing. What'd you learn? Nothing. I said, but that was a real big waste of time, which was my usual sarcastic response to that. Well, you know, and that's the response you're going to get. You got to spend a lot of time before you're ever going to get any kind of intimate communication from your kids. And the way that starts is it starts when they're little. You have to talk to them when they're little. You know, when they're little, they'll talk about anything. You know, they just run their mouth all the time. James is nodding, they just run their mouth all the time. And it's like, I can't even stand the incessant babble after a while. But you better stand it. You better pay attention to them. You better encourage that, because when they get to be 12 or 13, you're going to want to know what they're thinking. And if they're not in the habit of talking to you at that point, then you've got a hard uphill battle trying to find out anything from them. I remember when I was a kid, come home from school, you know, my mother would be busy in the kitchen doing whatever she was doing, you know, and there was a stool in the side of the kitchen there, and I'd perch on that, and you know, she'd give me a cookie or a piece of bread with butter on it or something, and you know, then I'd just chatter away about whatever had happened, you know, and she was always there, always ready to listen. So, you know, I felt comfortable as I got older talking to them. It was just the habit of our life. You know, and I know with my kids, you know, I got so sick and tired of reading the same little books over and over, but the little puppy with his tongue lung hanging out and counting the five mittens and the berries on the bush and buzzing bees around, you know, you got one, that's pretty interesting. Second child, it gets like, yeah, I know this pretty well. Third, fourth, it's like, but you better talk to them when they're little, because you're going to want them to talk to you when they are older. Really, in some ways, we need to talk to them about important things, not just the trivial things, but the important things too. And we need to start early. That's what Deuteronomy 6 and verse 7 says. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 7 really talks about, describes the family relationship. And it says, you shall teach the commandments diligently to your children. You shall talk to them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You know, and of course, it's like the kids are like, they're always talking to me. Parents are always telling me this stuff. Well, they need to hear it. And they need to know that you talk to them about those things that are important and that you care about those things. Because how else are they going to learn? How else are they going to learn to discern good from evil unless we help them sort through those things? And we ought to talk about that when you're reading the little children's books. What kind of moral lessons are there? What kind of contradictions are there between that and the message of the Bible? We need to help them sort through those things because they're going to need to do that when they get older. And I'll tell you this, big part of communicating is listening. Listening. And the truth of the matter is, when we're talking very frequently, what we're doing is we're waiting for the other person to finish, if we're polite. Sometimes we're not even polite, we just interrupt them. And we wait for them to finish, and then we're all the time framing what we're going to say. We're not really listening to what they have to say. Proverbs 18 and verse 2 says, a fool has no delight in understanding, but in expressing his own heart. That's not really communicating when you have... I mean, I've been with people and in families, you know, and they just take their turn. You know, you sit and talk, and one of them will talk to you about something, and then the other one will talk to you about something entirely different. But, you know, it's not like there's a community, not like there's a communion, not like there's a communication of common understanding. They're just waiting to say what they want to say. We just don't hear and understand what other people are saying very well. The modern proverb has it something of this effect. I know that you believe that you understand what you think that I heard, but what I don't think is that you don't realize what you think you heard is not what I meant. We mean something when we say, but people don't get that right away because they are expecting something or they're filtering it through their own point of view. And we can see that with others. But do we do the same thing when other people are speaking to us? We have to learn to listen to what the other person has to say. And we need to go to the intent of what they're saying, not just to the superficial words about that. We need to give them the benefit of the doubt in the conversation so that they feel like they can talk to us and talk through their feelings and talk through the difficulties that they're experiencing. Men need to learn to listen to their wives. They need to learn to understand them, which is lifelong project. And women need to listen to their husbands. Because here's the problem, women generally are much better at talking than men. And so when the men, you know, kind of circling around the topic, you know, kind of, you know, the women just kind of bulldoze right on over them, you know, right to what they think is the heart of the matter. And they don't give their husband a chance to talk. They don't listen to what their husbands have to say. Men, for the most part, are pretty slow to warm up to talking about their emotions, to talking about intimate kind of things. And that means a wife has got to be patient. It's not like talking to women. It's not like, you know, they're just going to tell you everything, you know, that's the secret of their life. Men are going to be slow to do that. And you got to tease it out of them. You got to listen. You got to ask the right questions. You got to be patient before they get to that point. Communication. One of the aspects of communicating is the issue of dealing with difficulties, arguing. I was doing some pre-marriage counseling with a couple a few years ago, and I was trying to talk about this issue of arguing, and I was surprised to hear her say, my parents have never had an argument. Well, I mean, her parents are mighty nice people, I know that, you know, and, you know, they they get along real well. I see them, you know, now the kids are all out of the house. I see them, you know, we go to a restaurant and there they are chatting away with one another. I'm sure they get along very well, but they've never had an argument. There are only two reasons a married couple never have an argument. One is there's no reason for them to argue because one of them is so overwhelming, overbearingly powerful, the other one doesn't have a chance and no reason for them to argue. Or the other reason they don't argue is because they're too afraid that the relationship is too tender and too delicate that any kind of disagreement is going to separate them. So they just pretend there are no problems. Well, actually, I told her to go, you know, and ask her mother and her dad about that. And they came back and reported to me a week or so later, and they said, you know, she came and asked me about that, and she said she told her that we'd never argued, and they were laughing, guys. And I said, well, that's good. You hid that from the kids. That's great. But couples argue. The thing is, you have to argue in the right kind of way. Can you argue in a way so as to end up with something constructive at the end as opposed to being destructive about that? And one of the things you got to learn is, as we were talking about this morning, is to forgive the things of the past. You don't have what are called shotgun arguments or kitchen sink arguments. That is, you know, as soon as one little thing comes up, you just throw everything at the person, you know. Every problem you've ever had, you just kind of string them all together and barrage the person with that. You got to stick to one thing at a time. And you got to stick to the present. One man said, I can't argue with my wife because she gets historical. And the guy said, you mean hysterical? No, historical. She brings up everything. You know, and you can't argue with something like that. One thing at a time. You know, stick to that. And, you know, don't stay angry. You can't stay angry, you know, about the issue over periods of days. The Apostle Paul says that you ought not to let the sun go down on your anger. You ought to work something out, some kind of compromise, or at least agree to a truce about that before you go to bed at night. Pretty good reasoning about that. But at least not carry that grudge on and on and on and on into the future. Doctor delivered the bad news to one who'd been bitten by a rabid dog, and you know he felt bad about how graphic he'd been, so he went back in the room, and there she was writing, scribbling away furiously, and he said, you know, maybe I was too harsh, you're writing your will, maybe that's, and she said, no, I figured if everything you told me was true about, you know, being bitten by a rabid dog, I'm just making a list of people I want to bite before I die. So, no. We don't want revenge. We want to work out something. And my wife's advice about that is don't both be angry at once, which is, of course, pretty hard, I guess. Take turns. And then she usually adds an aside, you know, I'm still waiting for my turn. So my advice about that is, like in most turn taking, you need to not make your turn too long. You need to give the other person an opportunity. And never make your spouse look bad in front of other people. If you're going to argue, you keep it between the two of you. You don't drag other people in. You know, of course, the mistake people want is they want to get some kind of adjudicator, some kind of mediator. So, you know, she wants to get her parents or he wants to get his parents. That's not going to work. That's just going to spread the problem to other families. You need to settle it between yourself. And you don't make the other person look bad in front of other people. I mean, you know, go back to what we were saying this morning. If you really love them, you know, they look bad, you look bad. You want to settle that between the two of you. And you need to be tolerant of the other person's faults. You know, sometimes the students will ask me, what's the most important quality in somebody that I marry? And I finally figured this is probably it. You need somebody who's tolerant. I mean, I see you. You need somebody who's tolerant. I need somebody who's tolerant. We all need somebody who's tolerant because we got problems and we need to recognize we have shortcomings and we need to be tolerant and we need to be, you know, willing to concede that to other people as well. You know, they've got weaknesses. You're not going to make them over. You're not going to make them perfect. You just have to be tolerant about that. And if you are arguing and you have some difficulty, some quarrel going on, you have to learn to accentuate the positive. There are positives about the relationship. The very fact that you're angry with the person, the very fact that you have a disagreement means that you care about them. You know, we don't, The people we don't care about, we don't argue with. It doesn't make any difference what they think. I mean, there are plenty of people that I encounter on a day-to-day basis. I don't much care whether they're Democrats or Republicans or, you know, whether they think, you know, bombing in Iraq's a good thing or a bad thing or whether they care about what the kids eat for. I mean, I don't care about them enough, maybe I should, to get angry with them about that. But my wife started to express some of those opinions. I'd be pretty upset about that because I care about her. There's something positive even in the fact that we care about one another enough to be made angry by what they have to say. But we need to accentuate the positive so we don't just pay attention to the negatives and see everything from that kind of light. Well, lots of other perhaps useful keys to arguing effectively, but truth of the matter, it comes down, you know, people say argue fair, you know, follow the rules, but that's the whole thing about arguing, you know. When you're mad, you don't want to follow the rules. It's like war, so you don't care about that. So the best advice I've ever seen about that is a man named Kirkpatrick says, you should be like two children that are best friends when they have an argument. Because, you know, they will say ugly things to one another. I used to hear my boys outside talking to the neighbor boy up the street, and, you know, they were best friends, but they'd get upset with one another, usually over basketball or, you know, the rules of some game they'd made up, and, you know, they misunderstood the rules that the other person had made up. And, you know, it was like, I don't want to ever see you again. And, you know, then, you know, he goes storming off, and you think, this is terrible, you know, childhood friendship is ruined at this very point. But you know it's not. He's back the next day. It's all past, forgotten, gone. They're moving on with the next thing. How can they do that? How can the kids do that? And the adults can't. That's the way it is. We're best friends. We argue. Maybe we get upset. Maybe we say things we ought not to have said. But tomorrow, we're back to playing together as we ought to. And one of the things, you know, that helps get past that is to go on and do things together. Instead of going to separate corners and sulking, you know, we go on with our lives and we carry on doing the common activities together. So that's number three, how to make marriages happy, families happy, is to do things together. Husbands and wives need to spend time together. And, you know, we spent a lot of time together, generally most of us, when we were dating, when we were courting, when we were trying to get to that point of being married. And now we're married. It's not like, okay, I've got that taken care of. Now I can look abroad and see other things I need to do. No, we need to continue to spend time together. In Deuteronomy chapter 24, and verse 5, one of those kind of little tidbits of passage that are stuck in there about the laws for the Israelites that, you know, you kind of are surprised about sometimes, but pleasantly surprised. Deuteronomy chapter 24 and verse 5, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war or be charged with any business. He shall be free at home 1 year and bring happiness to his wife whom he has taken. At least 1 year. You know, he should consolidate that relationship, doing things together. And if that's good in the first year, then that's good in the second year. And in the third year, he needs to spend time with his wife. Now, careers are important. Paying the bills are important. We get caught up in the urgent, the demanding affairs of life. Or sometimes we just get caught up in the routine of life. You got to get up and you got to fix your breakfast and you got to go off to work. Then you got to come back home and you got to take care of the yard. You got to take care of the house. We got to do those things and we just forget what's really important. And that is spending time with our spouse, spending time with our husband or our wife. So many times when marriages are threatened and couples are like, I don't know what we can do to save our relationship. The advice is pretty simple. Just do things together. You know, and it doesn't even have to be something. Of course, some people think this is the way it is, to be something big, something important, something dramatic, like the Naaman complex, you know, we got to go on some big trip together. No, mop the floor together, well, maybe that, I don't, that might be going. But do things together that you can do together. There has to be companionship in a relationship. There has to be companionship for there to be a marriage. And many marriages break up just because there's no companionship. They may not have any other real serious problems, but they just don't spend time together. And we need to spend time with our children, too. And I think, you know, sometimes parents seem to feel like when they brought them into the world and, you know, they provided for their physical needs, that they've done their duty toward their children. But that's just the beginning of it, maybe even the least part of it. We have to spend time with our children. And you can do this yourself sometime. Just stop and think back to the most pleasant, the happiest times of your childhood. And for most people, when they start thinking about the most happy times of their childhood, it's the times when they were with their families. You know, and it may not be that that's the way their time with their family was all the time, but those are the happy times. And those happy times emerge out of a lot of time spent together. You know, it takes a certain kind of, there used to be this thing a few years ago when wives were first starting to go into the workplace back in the 70s, you know, and people were concerned about what was going to happen to the children if the mothers weren't spending much time with them. And so they conceived this idea of quality time with their children. So, you know, we're not going to have as much time to spend with them, but what time we spend with them will be quality time. So we'll like have, you know, dates with our children. Well, you try that with a 5-year-old. You say, you know, we got an hour now. We're going to spend some quality time together this hour. I'll meet you at 6 o'clock tomorrow evening. We'll do some quality time together. That's not the way quality time works with children. Quality time comes up on you unexpectedly. It's just in the midst of a quantity of time. And there it is. That moment that you couldn't plan for, that you couldn't create if you wanted to. That's the kind of time we need to spend with our children. You know, you try that with your boss. You say, look, I'm not coming in, you know, the 40 hours a week. I'm just going to give you some quality time, you know. I'll schedule a little quality time for you next week. No, that doesn't work. We know it doesn't work, and it doesn't work with children either. Most people in America today say the lack of time is really their greatest challenge. I remember back in the 50s and 60s, you know, they were talking about technology was going to solve all our problems. And they used to tell us, some of y'all remember this, they used to tell us that, you know, by the year 2000, you know, sometimes it'd be like by 1980, we're going to be working 30 hours a week. You know, some people won't even have to work at all. Everything will be taken care of. Are you kidding me? I don't know anybody that works 30 hours a week unless they have a part-time job. Then they try and get 2 part-time jobs so they can work 60 hours a week. You know, and there just never seems to be enough time. But we make time for that which is important, and we need to make time for our parents, and we need to take time for our children. We need to make time for our spouse. It is really critically important that we spend time with our children. I did a study a few years ago, and of course these are politically incorrect studies these days, but merit scholars. What's the difference between the kids that have, you know, earned merit scholarships and those who haven't? That is the kids who do really well in school, make top scores on the standardized test. And one of the things they found, surprisingly enough, was, you know, among these students that are doing really well in school is the fact that they eat supper with their families. And it's like, what in the world does that have to do with it, eating supper with? But those are the kind of families that spend time together. And spending time together is what teaches children responsibility, which teaches them kind of values of hard work, which teaches them the direction that they want to go, which provides for them the security and maturity by which they can accomplish those goals. We need to spend time with our families. And 4, appreciation. Appreciation, which may seem like kind of a weak word because we've been talking about love, but enacted love in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, not the kind of powerful emotional love that most people think about. But we need to learn to appreciate one another. in our families. We need to learn to appreciate our spouse for who they are. Sometimes it's clear that people are getting married to a person, not so much because they appreciate that person, but because they think that that person has like potential, like maybe they can do something really good with him. And sometimes that's the way the women think, you know. You know, we can get him a haircut, we can get him some better clothes, and, you know, we can make him into somebody else. Well, obviously wives improve their husbands. But if you don't appreciate the qualities that he has before you get married, you're probably not going to appreciate the consequences after you're married. And men are just as bad. You know, it's like they get married for pretty superficial kind of reasons, appearance, you know, and they want the girl to cut her hair just this way or wear just this kind of makeup. And if they could get that, just that right look. But do they really appreciate her for who she is? Do they appreciate the other person's qualities as a person? That's what we all want, is that kind of appreciation. And in happy families, I can tell you this, that as opposed to what we were talking about this morning with injustice collectors, people in the family who are always finding things wrong, and they, you know, they can nurture those resentments about how unjust people have been and how badly they've been treated, and they can, you know, that resentment can fester. As opposed to that, in happy families, what you find are people that are, well, really they're diamond hunters. They go through the day looking for good things in their spouse or good things in their children or even good things in their parents to appreciate and to focus on. Too many people, you know, they forget about the good things and they just focus on the few bad things. We want to be appreciated. You know, that's one of the greatest things in our life, is to know that somebody appreciates us. And the person who's most important to us, our wife or our husband, appreciates us. That's like the best thing in the world, you know, as opposed to criticizing. You know, that's what the wife says. Nothing I do pleases him. Everything I do displeases him. And he just criticizes everything that I do. I can't stand it anymore. Well, I doubt that any of that's true, but it seems true to her. And really, you know, if you ask him, you say, oh, she does a lot of great things. Have you ever told her that? Do you express your appreciation? Well, probably not. And he says, I don't know if I can keep on to go into this job every day and keep on going to work and supporting her and the kids and keep going back to home when, you know, they don't even care. All I am is a paycheck to them. Have they expressed any appreciation? And, you know, that's not true either. I guarantee you, she has a real sense of appreciation for what her husband does, but she hasn't told him about that. We want that kind of appreciation. We long for the same kind of things. And really, you know, probably there are plenty of people outside that marriage relationship that would think, you know, he's successful and accomplished and she's a great housekeeper and mother. But that doesn't matter, really. What you care about is that your husband or your wife appreciates you. You know, we want the respect and the appreciation. And we need to hear that from our husband or our wife. And you know about children? Do you know what children complain about when they get old enough to complain? They complain about, you know, my parents never care about all the things I do that are right. But let me mess up one time and they're all over me. And, you know, sometimes that's true because parents are always watching, you know. They want the best for their children and they want to stop the mistakes before they get big. But the truth of the matter is we need to express appreciation for the good things that they do. No, I know family over a number of years, and they had a daughter that lots of people thought, you know, that's the kind of child we would like to have. She was good in school. She didn't get into real trouble. And, you know, I'm sure they appreciated that too. But all they could think about was your room is messy. And they just were on her all the time about her messy room and about how she didn't do housework around the house. They didn't compliment her on the good grades she got. They didn't compliment her on the fact that she, you know, avoided the wrong kind of friends and she had the right kind of friends. And she just got more and more resentful and bitter about that. And pretty soon she quit paying attention to schoolwork. She quit working on trying to have the right kind of friends. And the next thing you know, she'd left home. And all of that could have been avoided had they just expressed their appreciation for the things that she was doing. You know, one of the things that we could do in our marriages, one of the things we could do in our families, is to practice the old prescription of one compliment a day. That's a whole lot more helpful than an apple a day that keeps the doctor away. One compliment a day. Try and compliment everybody in the family once a day for something. Boy, it goes a long way to know that people appreciate you. Well, the last point I was going to make to lead to the invitation was that we need to have the right kind of value system. Godliness is, as the Apostle Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6, a means of great gain with contentment. All of these things are really pretty good, but they are not really worth much unless we have God in our lives. And if we have God in our lives and we can practice these kind of things as well, then we can have the kind of families that God intends for us to have. We can have the kind of love and the kind of support that can help us to be the kind of righteous, godly people that can be a glory to Him in this world. And if you're here this evening and you haven't made yourself right with God, if you haven't got that in your lives, that's the first thing you need to take care of. And as we're gathered here in Jesus' name, He extends His invitation to you. If you have reason to respond to that invitation, we encourage you as we stand and sing.